Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
This is Eric Jochimsthaler. I'm the author of The Indirection Field, the revolutionary new way to create shared value for business, customers, and society. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Toll!
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I produce this podcast to help us both keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow faster by taking a sales-based approach to marketing. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. And if you're one of the many, many listeners who's left a review on Apple Podcasts, I want to drop a little something in the mail to thank you. Details after the interview. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Eric Jochimsthaler to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, The Interaction Field, The Revolutionary New Way to Create Shared Value for Businesses, Customers, and Society, published by Public Affairs, an imprint of Perseus Books, a subsidiary of Hachette. Eric Jochimsthaler is the founder and CEO of Vivaldi, one of the largest independent global strategy and business transformation firms with offices in the US, Europe, and Asia. He has lectured and held faculty positions at many of the world's leading business schools, including Harvard Business School, Yale, Columbia, Dartmouth, University of Southern California, University of Virginia, and Duke. He is the author and co-author of more than 100 articles published in highly respected journals, as well as two award-winning books, Brand Leadership, Building Assets in an Information Economy, and Hidden in Plain Sight, How to Find and Execute Your Company's Next Big Growth Strategy. Eric has been featured in USA Today, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and on CNBC, among others, and he writes regularly for Harvard Business Review. And in 2017, he was voted a top 25 influencer of chief digital officers, and he was inducted as the 2017 fellow of the ISBM Institute for his lifetime contribution in academics, thought leadership, and practice in B2B marketing strategy and digital innovation. And interesting fact, he is originally from the ancient spa town of Baden-Baden, Germany. Eric, congratulations on the Interaction Field and herzlich willkommen to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Danke, danke, Douglas. That is a mouthful of all of these things. It embarrasses me. Is that what you do to participants here, to authors? You embarrass them first about their accomplishments or lack thereof?
Well, there's nothing here that's embarrassing. I'm just excited to be able to interview over 300 interviews, and you're only the second author I've interviewed originally from Germany. And as we were talking about before we started recording, I lived in Germany for 3 years, and I've forgotten probably all of my German. Although as I drink German beer, a lot of it starts to come back to me. Well, that's not really true. Yeah,
it happens for all the Germans. You know, the more they drink, the better they get in the language.
Yeah. So actually, when I drink German beer, it doesn't really improve my German, but it improves my perception of my German. And I think that's very important. So you do what you can. And I am the king of stupid questions. Before we go further, I have to ask a question and ask you to explain what is value, because the subtitle to your book is the revolutionary new way to create shared value. And in case there's just one person out there that doesn't understand what that means, I mean, they could be thinking value. Does that mean a cheap product or something? It's not at all. It is. Explain what is meant by creating value.
Yeah. You know, like years ago, value, when companies talked about we create value, then they said that we're creating a better car. BMW says we create the ultimate driving machine. BMW, Mercedes, and Audi says we are not just recreating your car. We create a premium luxury experience. And that used to be the game. You know, we are better washing machine. We have better TVs. We have better, faster, cheaper. That was sort of the game. And people have needed that. You know, we needed cars. We needed washing machines, houses, and all these things. But I think today, consumers don't look at buying just cars. They look for something else. They want mobility solutions or mobility. They want to solve for mobility. You don't want to buy a gift anymore and say, like, I buy flowers for my wife or beloved ones for an occasion. You want to please somebody. Express your feelings about somebody else. So the game is changing and has changed. The consumers have changed, and value now means solving for something for consumers, solving something much bigger. It's not about a better cancer drug, as I write in my book. It's about how do you enable me living with a cancer condition, let's say I have, or maybe survive the typical expectations. So I think the game is changing now, and value creation isn't something just by pushing out a product, but by actually solving sort of a significant challenge for consumers or for businesses and industry or society.
Great. Thank you for that. And I just want to quote from the beginning of the book here. Read one excerpt. For most of my career, which spans four decades, the conventional wisdom about a company's ability to create value was that it comes in the form of competitive advantage, differentiation, and growth, usually evaluated in terms of tangible assets, revenue, and profit. In today's digital age, characterized not only by networks, but by data-driven technologies, including artificial intelligence, machine learning, and soon quantum computing, we have to think differently about how businesses create value. The interaction field describes a new phenomenon that is just emerging and can be glimpsed in a handful of wildly successful companies such as Alibaba, Apple, Netflix, Google, and Amazon. It can also be found in some traditional businesses from farming to fashion. Interaction field companies thrive on the participation and value creation by many different groups, the company itself, its customers, suppliers, partners, and other stakeholders, as well as other entities you might not expect to see in the mix, such as competitors, observers, independent researchers, and government agencies. By participating in these interconnected groups, interaction field companies can achieve a kind of unstoppable momentum and wild expansion that I call velocity. It is a new form of multidimensional, constantly accelerating, explosive, and smart growth that goes far beyond the traditional measures of sales increase, profit, or market capitalization. So, Eric, our kids are about the same age. They're in their early 20s. And I recently took my daughter, Emma, to Manhattan because she just started a sales job there. She's just out of college. Mm-hmm. And I lived there for many years and left there about 20, 25 years ago. And it was interesting to go back. I'd been back once or twice, but I went back this time just to drop my daughter off. And then, and then I was no longer needed once I gave her some money, as you can imagine. So one thing that I noticed that was different is that the avenues were smaller, okay? Now, part of that is because of the pandemic where restaurants are now allowed to set up some tables out in the street inside a barrier so they can have outdoor dining. But the other thing that I was not there when I lived there in the 90s was this bike lane. And there's a bike lane on all these major boulevards. And generally, the bikes are going faster than the cars.
Yes.
So as I was there for just 2 days, I was dropping her off. We were about to cross a street and there was a red light. So we were able to cross and the cars were stopping. And she was a little bit ahead of me. And a bicyclist, as happened many, many times, came barreling through, ran right through the red light, was about to hit her. I reached up, grabbed her collar and pulled her back, and the bike just kept going.
Jeez.
Tell me and the listener what that story has to do with velocity, as you explain in your book about bikes and buses.
Yes. I was I use that analogy because I looked at the bus as an existing business, an existing company. And when you have an existing business, an existing company, you have a factory or you have a retail store, you have invested in a lease, you decorated your, let's say, a retail store, you have commitments to employees. And what happens is, and the bike lane, the bike example in the first chapter of the book, is there comes a company around that doesn't have that, that doesn't have a factory, that doesn't have a retail presence, that hasn't invested in a lease or signed up for a 10-year lease, that hasn't really employees, and actually passes you and with a power that causes the same harm that a truck can or a bus can do. And if you think of New York, you know, think of this, you know. But one of the things that an immigrant coming to New York, one of the first jobs many immigrants has done is they drive taxis. And in order to drive a taxi, you needed to buy a license called a medallion license. Then you need to take tests, you know, road tests and all of these things. And as an immigrant, you had to figure out, you know, you had to memorize all the streets and all these things. And you get a license and all of these.
And
things.
Wasn't the medallion several hundred thousand dollars at its highest
million.
Price? $1 million.
The value was the medallions used to auction away for over $1.3 million. So when you start as an immigrant, let's say, you couldn't get a medallion taxi. There were others who had medallion taxis. Michael Cohen, the associated with the Trump administration, he was actually owner of many of these medallion taxis. But as an immigrant, what you would do is you would drive for someone who had a taxi and who had a medallion license. But you know, there are 13,000 out there right now, where there used to be 13,000 on the average. They never changed. 13,000 of these taxis. And guess what? If you look at it today, you don't have 13,000. You have 13,000 plus 88,000 other cars out there called Ubers and Lyfts. And you know what's so interesting? Those drivers don't have the same driver's tests. They don't oftentimes own actually the car. The Uber or Lyft doesn't own the car. They are not employees, so they don't have to buy a license. All they get is a mobile phone from Uber, buy a mobile phone and download a software. So without assets, even Uber doesn't own the cars, right? Suddenly, Uber has now, and Uber Lyft together have 88,000 cars out there competing with 13,000 medallion taxis.
And they've driven down the value of a medallion tremendously.
It's a painful. I have the charts on those, how painful it is. So that's really, that's that new sort of competition. And it has caused a lot of challenges. You know, the taxi drivers hate Uber drivers because for a number of reasons. They don't know the rules of how do you stop in a lane? How do you let passengers out of your car? They just stop in the middle of the street. There's actually a congestion that you may have seen when you were here, Douglas, that you haven't had seen before. You know, it's harder. The license plate begins with a T and ends with a C. If you go on a street today, the license plate for those Uber and Lyft drivers, you notice, everybody knows them because starts with T and ends with a C. And you see more T and more of those than you see taxis on the road.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I didn't realize that. So the taxis could be like the buses in your analogy, and
that's right.
The bicycles are like the Uber and the Lyfts.
And so, I have a friend in New Jersey who is a family, is an Italian immigrant who built actually a thousand of these taxis. He lost his entire wealth that he has created.
Oh my goodness.
Has been wiped out just on this sort of scenario.
It's he had a thousand. He had a thousand medallions.
Yeah, wow. He was a really interesting fellow.
At one point, that would have been worth about $1 billion, right there.
Oh yes, right there. He was incredibly wealthy.
Before we go into some of the key terms from the interaction field, I want to mention something that's at the very end of the book, which I think will get the listener interested or frightened. You know, and one of them, you write that McKinsey predicts that $60 trillion in revenue, or roughly 30% of all global revenues, will be accounted for by interaction field style ecosystems by 2025. So let's step back for just a minute there and talk about this connected world we're in. And you describe there's three eras of development, and the third of which we're starting into now.
Yes. When I came to the U.S. 95, at that time there were these Google guys out there called Sergio Brin and Larry Page, some two PhDs that worked on their doctoral thesis, and they said that there's this internet out there, but you can't find anything on the internet. But if we could create this technology called a search engine, we could actually, because the internet connects information or websites, you could actually find stuff on the internet. And that was about 95. To me, this is the first era where something connected, namely the internet. It was the first era, and Google came up with a technology called search. And then there was this one guy somewhere in Seattle up there. And this guy says, well, you know, if on one side is information or one consumer or one website, and on the other side is another website with information, maybe I can put books on that website, and then I could start a new technology called e-commerce, and that became Amazon, of course, as you well know. And that was the first wave of connectivity, where basically information connects to information, or in some cases also books, and then it becomes other things. And then what happens is that's 1995, and Google became the dominant search engine. There were 12 others, and Amazon competed. Then in around 2007, 2009, 2004, in those days, the second era started, and it wasn't about connecting information or website. It was about connecting people. And then there was Friendster, and then there was MySpace, and then there was in this Harvard dorm room, there was this guy called Mark Zuckerberg, you know, who wanted to have a Harvard network, a Harvard Connections, I think it used to be called, which of course became Facebook, and says, we can actually find friends and people on the internet and connected people. And in 2009, that became some big deal when Apple came around and says, you know, you don't need to do this on a computer. You can actually do this on a smartphone, that technology. And when that became, that's to me the second era where actually people connected. And what happened in these last years, over the last 2 years, 10 years, is it's not just people or information that connects. What now is happening, and we are just in that stage, Douglas, is we are in that third wave. Internet of Things, machine learning, AI, and all of those technologies, cloud computing. Forget about the technology, because what it really does one thing, all of them, there's one thing, and that is it connects everything. Things, companies, 24/7, anywhere, anytime, all, you know, that, and that's connectivity. It's now called in the academic circles hyperconnectivity, that everything connects. And to me, that is the single biggest trend you have to think about, because that's where the opportunity starts. Whether it is Uber, it is Airbnb, or what is Apple today, or some of the companies I describe, more traditional companies, they leverage that technology, that connectivity. And that is sort of where the biggest opportunities are, and that's why I wrote the book.
So one last thing I want to help the listener with, setting the stage, before we go crazy into the interaction field and never return, is to talk about the other standard approaches to value creation. If you could just remind folks what, you know, is the value chain and the platform, the other two that are out there.
Yes. So the value chain is, has, it's been like that for the last hundreds of years. The first, the second, the third industrial revolution, they were all built around the idea of a value chain. And that means that a company, one company, needs to perform a set of activities, the way they source a product, the way they do R&D, the way they do manufacturing, the way they do marketing, the way they do sales, and the way they do customer service. That's the value chain. These sequential linear activities that you perform in a company, and a competitive advantage or value is when one company says, we are better in one or several of these things. You know, BMW says, we have German engineering. We are better engineers. We are better designers. And we have amazing marketing people that can convince Americans and other people in the world that we, only us, sell the ultimate driving machine. And that's differentiated. And Mercedes says, hold on. We can, we are better on technology, better on this. And that's the value chain business, where you produce, you fulfill a certain functions in order to produce a better. IKEA says we can create design, a Scandinavian design at a low price. And we perform a set of activities better and differently from competitors, and that makes IKEA IKEA. And that's a good model, but that's the traditional way. 100 years ago, 50 years ago, that's always been. Then what happens is this, because of interactivity, these digital models started, and these digital business models. And one example of that is a platform. A platform, and actually, you know, those platforms go back. The first time written about that was in 1994 by two French professors. Jean Tirole is one of them, and Jean Rocher is another person. They wrote this obscure paper in 2004, and in 2014 won the Nobel Prize on it. And they said, it's not just, it's, there is actually a platform that you can build. And a good example of a platform is actually Uber. And we just mentioned that earlier. So on one side of the platform, you have riders, namely people like you and me who look for a ride to go from point A to point B, wherever you are in whatever city. And on the other side, you have another sort of group of people, two-sided marketplace. There's another marketplace of drivers, you know, some the various drivers that are almost like consumers that are participating in sort of a community of drivers. And Uber is only matching the drivers with a rider or Lyft. That's what's called a platform. There are many others. Airbnb is a platform, you know, in a way, because they say, Eric has a spare room in New York. There's a Douglas comes with his daughter to New York. She moves in her apartment and she doesn't want to stay with daddy. And daddy rents in over through Airbnb a night in the house or in the apartment of Eric. And that becomes a platform transaction at Airbnb.
Although, Eric, I would hope that maybe now that we've kind of become acquainted, we could cut Airbnb out of the transaction here and I could just pay you directly.
Yeah, that's right. That's their problem. Yes, exactly.
So that's the platform. Okay, the value creation business and the platform. Yep. Okay, now let's get into the interaction field. And you write that if you wish to create an interaction field company, you need to design and build the three elements that constitute an interaction field. And this isn't to the listener. This isn't fair to Eric because much of the book is about this. But you need to build a nucleus of participants, an ecosystem of partners and contributors, and a group of market makers that exert influence on the field, all of them linked through data. So please walk us through what those three things are. And there's plenty of examples in the book that we can also talk about.
You see, the platforms have their problems. We know that there are challenges. I mentioned earlier the congestion that platforms create. And what I thought is while it's a good business model, it's good for Uber to be Uber, but what does a taxi company do? What does an existing company do when they already have a value chain, when they already have a pipeline that pushes out, let's say, a product? How do they take advantage of that? What do you do when you just have a retail store and you're going through the pandemic? And how do you use this new connectivity that everybody talks about, or digital sort of tools, in order to do business? So that was my interest in the book. And the nucleus, thanks for asking the question, Douglas. The nucleus is what I think is, and what I've seen with companies succeeding in this new world, is they say, I have already some existing customers. And the nucleus, if I need to build first interactions, the right interactions with that nucleus. And if you think about this, that's very important. Maybe I make an example with one company in the early chapters in the book, John Deere. They have thousands and thousands of farmers where they sell a tractor to, an $800,000 incredibly technology advanced tractor that is yellow and green tractor that is the pride of every farmer. But it sets you back three Rolls Royces, more or less, as a farmer. Imagine, so $800,000. So that's a transaction and a business, a value chain business that John Deere has. And so how do you become now an interaction field? How do you create a nucleus? So what John Deere has done is they created something they call the John Deere Open Platform. Actually, that's the exact name they created several years ago. And what they do is they have convinced many farmers, not all, a lot of them, but thousands of farmers, they've convinced them that would you share with us the data you have, and we put sensors on the field on a square foot level that will go to square inch level at one point in time. Right now it's a square foot level, on the conditions of the soil, the water it is, on the conditions of the plant, irrigation, when you seed, what time of the days you seed, what time of the month, and so forth, when you mow down, when you harvest, and all of those. So there are thousands of farms that are now facilitated, orchestrated by John Deere, that nucleus, where John Deere collects the data, augments them with weather data and other data, and then these are daily interactions and more often interactions that take place through these sensors on these fields, and then they feedback those data to the farmers. And guess what? A farmer says, "Hey, I can learn from my neighbor farm. You know, I have a farm. I have some problems over here. So farmers learn from others." So the first thing is that nucleus, to say, how do we enable farmers not only to just buy a better tractor, but enable farmers to actually interact with each other and then learn from each other, and also call, and that's sort of the nucleus of with their existing customers, if you will.
Right, and then we go to an ecosystem of partners and contributors.
Yeah, and so the ecosystem then is, you know, the traditional mindset You know, and I know you, the traditional mindset, Douglas, that you and I learned in business school or in a sales process is you say, like, how can I sell better than somebody else sell? How can I, you know, this over there is the competition, you know, how my tractor is better than somebody else's tractor and things like that. But then when you think differently and you say, hey, it's not about me selling more tractors. How can I, if my mindset is, how can I improve the pro instead of selling tractors? What is the tractor really about? The tractor is a way for the farmer to improve the productivity of the field. But the tractor can only do so much. What if John Deere says, in order to improve the productivity of the farm, what if I not only share those data that I have learned, that everything I learn about the field, just with other farmers? What if I try to sell more tractors? What if I now invite crop companies like Monsanto, or now called Bayer, or Dow Crop Sciences, fertilizer companies, and I invite ecosystem partners or participants, and that's the ecosystem. And we all look at the same data, and we say, how do we help this farmer to increase the productivity of the farm by less fertilizers or more fertilizers? What crop is actually surviving under this water condition, under this arid conditions, let's say, with the sun and the water and the heat and the cold, if you will. And now we are all working together. I can even invite competitors, several fertilizer competitors. I can start creating an ecosystem, and that becomes the ecosystem. Now,
okay, but Eric, let me ask, that ecosystem could also include a John Deere competitor like Caterpillar?
Yes, absolutely.
We got to explain that, because I think that seems like a stumbling block for people.
Yeah, so that's the real problem. The problem that when you are in our world, we always think of competition and disruption. You know, that sort of this fashion word that has become overly important. I think today, 2020, we are actually in a world of, and we are going from competition and disruption. That's that outmoded, outdated, geriatric way of thinking about
a win, kind of a win-lose, total sum
That's
type
right.
of game.
To a collaboration, participation, and engagement type world. For example, you know, you can, when you can actually, what John Deere does, they can say, okay, we give this to our farmers that work with us because they are like, they trust us and so forth. But much of the learning that takes place, you can also give to farmers. They ride on a Mahindra and Mahindra or Kubota, which is a Japanese competitor. It doesn't matter. And they all benefit. At the end of the day, remember the book title is Shared Value. Mm. If you share that with also competing farmers that compete, ultimately everybody benefits. You know, like you and I don't pay for Google, but somebody pays for Google. But for me and you, Google is free. It's the same principle in the farming business. So in the book, actually, you know, there are Douglas, I show many examples where competitors intensively work together now. And the reason why they do that is they realize is why they need to share with customers. The market actually size is growing for everybody. So everybody benefits.
Interesting. Yeah. So then that takes us to the market makers, which for me was
another layer. Yes.
Well, no, but what I was going to say is that's the part that I probably didn't understand as much.
Yeah.
And you didn't talk about it quite as much as the others. But what are the market makers?
Yeah. So you know, like in many worlds we think still today in some markets we think of now. Okay, before products competed and companies competed. There was this competition between companies and products. We talked about that earlier. And now the fashion word is ecosystem competition. You know, Apple ecosystem competes with Android, if you will. The iOS from Apple competes with Android. And that's just another form of competition. But I think we need to think beyond that. If you want to, what I have found is right now, as we speak, If we want to solve the real problems in the of farmers, right now, many farmers, actually small farms and large farms, but particularly small farms, are subsidized through government subsidies. The Department of Agriculture has to subsidize them because it is a difficult period of time. The pandemic has hit them extremely hard. There are harsh weather conditions this year, and there were situations with China, as you know, trade wars, that has made things significantly worse for farmers. So the government, the Department of Agriculture, subsidizes farmers so that they can have a livelihood still. And when you think about this, what if this rich data that John Deere collects, that it shares with fertilizer companies to sell fertilizers to the farms, crop companies who sell crop companies to farms, what if they share those data also with the Department of Agriculture? If they do that, then the Department of Agriculture is in the business of making sure that the food that we, all of us, you and I, and so many other Americans who live here, have a healthy food supply. 40 million Americans right now still don't have good food to eat. Actually, that in this country, out of 330 million, 40 million don't eat well. And so the Department of Agriculture is there to make sure that food is on the table for all people in this country. So that's the mission of the Department of Agriculture. Right now, they just give subsidies for farmers who don't make enough money so that they continue with a food supply. But what if the Department of Transportation uses all that money, Department of Agriculture, and becomes part of that interaction field and then optimizes on farm productivity and the profitability of the farm rather than just on surviving, you know, subsidizing so people don't go out, companies or families don't go out of business. Then you suddenly, everybody creates value. Even the Department of Agriculture fulfills its mission of serving the hungry and serving enough food on for Americans. At the same time, they actually help farmers because they improve the productivity of the farm. So that's the matter. So here's the thing. What if you, right now, the average farm in America has a productivity of 3,579 kilo per hectare. Right now, that's very good. Most America has the most profitable farms. If all farmers, if you do the best you can, the best tractor, the best fertilizer, the best, you do the best you can, the maximum you could increase that by 10% on a traditional approach. You know, better farms, better farming and things like that. But if you build that in the action field where everybody works together, including the Department of Transportation, in that those market makers, I call them. If you do that, you can actually increase double the productivity to 7,779 kilos per hectare. It's such a productivity improvement. And the beautiful thing is we can only think like that because we are in this third wave that I described earlier of where everything connects. This value creation is now possible and it never has been possible before. We are going into that future in an exponential way. That's what it's all about.
So the data, all this shared data that you talk about, yep, which comes about because of the hyperconnectivity, it's like the, yep, the data becomes the atomic particle of the ecosystem.
Well said. So well said, yeah. And you know, the old days, you know, it's sort of like I say, the old days, it's not that long, and many companies still think like that. They say like, oh, let's collect data from consumers. Oh, this is our proprietary asset. Oh, you know, we need to put them in data centers. Do you remember they used to put there's so extra security to go into data centers that where nobody can go? There are people with white coats, you know, running these big computers in order, because this is our proprietary data, our proprietary customer data. And 2020, we are now in a world where we say, well, it shouldn't be proprietary. We live in a pandemic. Nobody can do it alone. It's not about your own competitive advantage. If we really want to solve the problem in healthcare, in finance, in the agriculture, as an example we had, then we need to begin sharing those data and actually solve for some really intractable and difficult industry problems. Do you know that of in the oil in the not in the oil field in the agricultural field, 40% of the water that is used for irrigation, which is a really scarce resource, an expensive one, 40% never reaches the plant. Leakage, inefficiencies in the agricultural system. So by everybody using the data, by participating in this larger interaction field, we can reduce some of those inefficiencies that one industry has over the other industry, in this case, it's agriculture.
And there are many examples in the book of industries or ecosystems that are starting to move in this direction. And you also talk about some of the big famous companies that get it wrong. They think they're starting an interaction field, but they're really not. And then there's a very funny line in the book about how companies will pay lip service to this digital transformation. That's not at all what, like that steel company in Germany, that the big digital transformation they had is that they added email. But they did go on to succeed at the example of what you're talking about. One other thing I wanted to ask about from the book is that you write that there are two major factors that will have a significant impact on how companies can create shared value at an exponential rate. So in other words, you've got to get it going pretty quickly.
Yep.
You talk about framing and branding. Can you explain what those two concepts are?
Yeah. Let's stick with one example. We have is John Deere. You know, John Deere founded the company, $30 billion. And he used to say at the beginning, he says, as long as I am around, he said, you know, a tractor that has a John Deere name, has these green and yellow colors. As long as I'm around, you know, it's going to be the best technology, the best equipment for farmers in this wide land.
Which still sounds like 99.5% of every manufacturer.
Exactly. And that's the mindset, that the framing that John Deere had in mind is, I guarantee the best for my clients, for my farmers. And I am customer centric. I treasure, I value farmers. If you look 2020 and look at how John Deere, now the company, now speaks to and how they frame and how they brand their company and what they're all about, they say, our business is about serving those close to the land. Serving those close to the land. The tractor is a piece, of course, and they sell $30 billion of beautiful equipment.
But that's no longer in the sentence.
But no longer in the sentence. It's now, and when you say serving, what does that mean? Well, it's, let's look at KPIs. Let's look at sort of like, how do you measure that? Well, serving means what I'm interested as a farmer. Look, I'm interested. Number one, I'm interested in productivity, right? I need to get better, but I don't really care about productivity. I have a family to feed. I need profits. I need, so profitability per acre or productivity per hectare. That's what I want you to do. Dear John Deere, my serving those close to the land means you need to help me how to improve the productivity of the farm or the profitability per acre that I'm running my machines over. So if you do that, you're not going to do that with a better tractor, even if you put more technology on the tractor. If you do that, and if that's what you frame your business, you end up in the interaction field, in my opinion, as I described it.
So I just wanted to quote from one section on page 176, which there was a very nice summary of this. You say, interaction field companies accomplish what no other corporate form or business model has accomplished so far. They get very close to customers. They truly become a part of their lives, integrate into their activities, and earn the permission to solve major and minor challenges, problems, frictions, and pain points. To do all this, companies considering making a transition to the interaction field model ask themselves fundamental questions. Why does our company or product exist? What problems do we or can we help solve? Yeah. Who will collaborate with us to solve these problems? And how are we integrating seamlessly into the lives of our customers? The answer to these questions will open your eyes to latent interaction fields. And the answer always rests at the consumer's doorstep. To become an interaction field company, you must shoulder the burdens of the entire interaction field you wish to be a part of. So, Eric, if readers of the book only took one thing away from it, what would you hope it would be?
I think that what to me the most important thing is that years ago, a few years ago, just 3-5 years ago, this would almost always require something that maybe a large company can do, or maybe I need some technology. I don't have an expertise. I run just a retail store, let's say. So what has happened is that what got me so excited is that the one thing you can take away is that even if you're just a retail store and only have one storefront, let's say, or you're in any kind of business, you can. The technology right now is not only available, I describe it in the book how easy it is to you don't have to buy it anymore. You don't have to be a technology expert. It's simple technologies. You don't have to become an AI expert. So the big takeaway for me is technology now is available to make this happen. And it's whether you are a startup, or you're a big company, a traditional company, or you're just a local retail store, you can build an interaction field company. And you don't have to have big grandiose visions and press releases and announcement. You can build that step by step. And in the book, I show simply steps how companies out of nothing, literally, have been able to get to that, to a point where they made a store profitable that would on the local traffic never would have been profitable, for example. And so that's the beautiful thing. This is now possible at a reasonably low cost that everybody can sort of start thinking about it.
I had no idea about this. I learned so much. And it brought to mind, my hope for your book is that, so in the early 2000s, people were starting to read the Clutrain Manifesto, okay? Mm-hmm. And you can read it now, and it's so prescient about where things were going, particularly as it relates to marketing. And I would hope that people will be talking about your book for a long time to come to say, well, that was the first, or that was one of the books that really help people understand what an interaction field is.
Thank you. If you remember, Douglas, this book, I met one of the authors of the book the other day, and he lives here in New York, and he says markets are conversations at the time, and mm-hmm. that was one of the pieces of glue. And if you look at my book here, there is sort of an extension to that. It's not just about conversations. Consumers are active participants in value creating. Who is creating value in the farm? Farmers do, because farmers contribute those data. Farmers learn and share those data with everyone else. So farmer is not like this other person, this target market that you can push and position and convince as a salesperson to buy another tractor or a service contract to get some expensive repair at a local dealership. No, farmers actually, they are not, customer centricity. They are not the thing that we are positioning and targeting and make a deal with. No, farmers actually are part of our system, part of our company. They are inside now. It's not just a conversation. Farmers actively contribute in order to create value. It's no longer, the value is not in the factory. The value is in that interaction, that exchange, what I call that velocity, that takes place between the farmers and John Deere and everybody else in that interaction field. That's where value is created. It's a massive shift of how you build a profitable business.
Wake up, people. So, Eric, what books have most inspired your work and career?
You know, I in my career, in the early 90s, I got very passionate about the world of brands, because I felt that it's something magical what Harley Davidson can do and Nike can do. See, do you know that? Nike sells a commodity. It's a rubber shoe. And now they get Michael Jordan and everybody buys Michael Jordan shoes. And I celebrated Michael Jordan like forever.
Yeah, and so, you wrote Brand Leadership with David Ocker, who's been on the Marketing Book Podcast twice.
Exactly.
So there you need to write yet another book so you can catch up.
That's right.
With him.
I can't catch up with him. He's faster than me with everything, except for mountain biking. I'm faster than him.
Oh, wow. Trash talking on the Marketing Book Podcast. We're getting a little, just so the listener knows, we got some PhDs that are, you know, kind of trash talking, which, you know, you don't often expect. So brands, and you were fascinated with that. It is fascinating how, you know, like, why do I own a Harley Davidson? Well,
there we go.
They got me.
Yeah. So that was one big book that inspired me, that were the people that pioneered that area. And then, and over the years,
Was that a specific book you're talking about?
So that David Ocker and I, we met back in early 90s, and David Ocker wrote a book called Managing Brand Equity. And I realized that, wow, that I called him up and I said, David Ocker, please talk to me. I'm this German guy. He goes like, German guy that is at the beginning of a career. And I just think that this book is just a home run, you know, work with me. And we worked for 25 years.
That's great. And, you know, when I lived in New York, at one point I worked at J. Walter Thompson, and I was the account executive on the Listerine account. I first saw that book sitting on the desk of the brand manager at Listerine, David Ocker's book, Managing Brand Equity.
Well, I tell you, there was a day where David Ocker introduced me to Peter Ceausescu, or something is his name, the CEO of JWT. And he had an office on Madison Avenue. And he says, look, David is an academic. He's going to write more books. But you could, I offer you an office here, and you build a brand strategy business at JWT. That was an offer I had on the table back then.
But you didn't take it?
No, I didn't.
Well, he didn't mention that I had worked there, so maybe that was, you know, that could have pushed you over the edge.
Yeah, it would have been good fun.
Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading?
In the upcoming books here, I've read a few books. You know, I found that there is a book that I've just been reading from Rita McGrath called "Seeing Around the Corner." And I found that interesting because she wrote that book last year, and I just read it now, and she said that there are these inflection points in business, and you need to recognize these inflection points. And she describes one of the inflection points, also the way, this new way of business, this new way of creating value. But I think that's really, the inflection point idea is an old idea from Intel, if you remember, Andy Grove talked about it, but apart from that, I thought it was interesting because we live in a pandemic, and you know, so many businesses where you say are now facing this challenge where we say, is the pandemic just a very very deep recession like we had it in 2008 or downturn in the economy? Or are there some permanent shifts? Is there an inflection point of how we do business? And I think that she hit the nail with this one, and how to figure out, how do you can see basically that things are changing and they're not going to come back? And I think that's something we need to figure out in any business we are right now. That's why I like that book.
Yeah, Seeing Around Corners, How to Spot Inflection Points in Business Before They Happen. And I see that the late Clayton Christensen wrote the foreword to it.
Yeah.
Wow. I definitely have to check out that. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, and your company site and your personal site and your LinkedIn profile. And I hope that people will reach out and connect with you. And thank you for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone, which is hyper-connected, and you have subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The Interaction Field, The Revolutionary New Way to Create Shared Value for Businesses, Customers, and Society. The author is Eric Yoakumstaller. Eric, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Douglas. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, I would like to return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I will drop it in the mail to you. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on this show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.